Welcome to the Symposium of the Lotus Eaters. Today we're joined by Carl.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about value pluralism and its difference from value monism. Now, I want to say that I'm not entirely 100% sold on value pluralism, but I do think that it is a very interesting theory and a very helpful theory.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely side in its favor. But I think that it's a really interesting discussion to have and to try and find out what it is. Because I think that one of the major motives for this theory is that it shows us how we can have a much more complex account of ethical conflicts and ethical dilemmas, especially when they have to do with value. But also it can help us to understand how there are no easy answers, which is something that a lot of the time many people claim. And frequently, I think that they do so in a bad manner.
Mm.
And it's good to start by fleshing out what value monism is and what value pluralism is.
I agree.
So I think we should start with some fundamental distinctions. And the fundamental distinction would be one between instrumental value and ultimate value.
Mm.
One good example that comes to mind is money. So we frequently claim that money is not the end of life, but it can be a very useful means for achieving further goals, such as security and such as the opportunity to raise a family and also to have a good and prosperous society.
Well, I mean, definitionally, the value of money comes from its utility for other things.
Yes.
Like, there's no point having a pile of money. You actually need to use that instrumentally in order to gain goods and services. And so that's a great example, actually.
I think it is because it functions like an instrument. We can use that instrument in order to achieve a further purpose.
Mm.
You could say an Aristotelian would say something like happiness or
whatever it
eudaimonia,
is.
Eudaimonia, whatever.
Yeah. Whatever it is.
How he would flesh it out.
Yeah.
Now, another interesting thing to note is that there are several accounts with respect to value.
Mm-hmm.
So the major distinction is that between realism and anti-realism. And we have other also views within the realist camp that are very different to each other. They differ significantly, like value objectivism, relativism, subjectivism. These are just three that comes to mind.
Mm.
Let us just start with value realism and value anti-realism. So an anti-realist position about something is a position that basically denies it. So I would say that frequently we have the experience of, we do experience value. In our normal daily lives, we do experience things like ethical dilemmas.
Mm-hmm.
And we do think that there are some things that are of value, some others that are of negative value, you could say. Others, they're indifferent. But generally speaking, we do think that there is such a thing as value.
It seems to be undeniable.
Yes. I think that it is undeniable, but unfortunately, we do have people who deny it.
Okay, of course we do.
Yeah, because they have to give a picture that differs from others to make a name.
Yeah.
And it is interesting to see how they deny it, because the way they deny it, I think, is really telling of a kind of full-scale assault on the first person.
Really?
Yes, which isn't just located on our discussion today about value. I think it is basically one of the scourges of contemporary life, that we have all sorts of theories that in an ideological fashion, and they're not necessarily political theories. In fact, I have materialism in mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it does function like an ideology. Maybe we'll disagree on that.
No, I agree with you completely on that. So let me just, because I don't know what the anti-realist theories are. What is the counter-argument? Because surely the only proof we need that there are things such as values is that we value things. Surely that is the only proof that would be required to satisfy that criterion.
Okay, this is one way of viewing it, and
right.
This is one way of countering the anti-realist position.
Yeah.
But this is much more conducive to relativism or subjectivism.
Right. So they're not, well, yes, I'm not saying that there are objective values embedded in the universe and something has intrinsic value. Gold is valuable because we impose value upon it. That's fine.
You could say this, yes. Yeah. And the basic thing is that in philosophy and in thinking, we try to give an account of the human condition and also of life. We try to understand the universe around us and our place within it. And there is such a propensity that people have to want very economical theories in explaining stuff. So for it's frequently called as Occam's razor when we are told that we should constantly opt for the most simple theory with the highest explanatory power. So frequently when we have rival theories that try to explain a set of phenomena or a number of phenomena, according to that methodological principle, we should accept the theory that is committed to the fewer entities. Because, for instance, the materialist does not want to to incorporate things like mind, form, or
spirit,
things like that.
Yeah.
Or they want to give a materialistic account of it, which implies ultimately that anything that we frequently talk about when we refer to these notions, they want to say that we have a very mistaken view of them. And they are going to give a materialistic account of it that ultimately tries to explain each phenomena in terms of, you could say, matter in motion.
Yeah, mechanistic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that basically this is a major problem in the last 400 years of thinking because it completely contaminates the way we try to think about stuff and that it creates a problem because you could say that when we dislike something and we want to reject it, we try to look at alternatives. But if the alternative is also contaminated by the thing we want to counter, then we don't really create an alternative.
Yeah.
So personally, if you ask me, I think that we need to completely reject this materialistic and mechanistic account of the human being that is really popular in the last 400 years. And it does seem to contaminate culture because now, for instance, let us think of an example. Let's think of love. The first person experience tries to give a sort of transcendental nature to love.
I don't even think it's sort of. I think, yes. I think that there is a kind of metaphysical body that is attached to our concept of love. I don't know how to, and not just that, but our relationships themselves, like all of morality seems to exist in the metaphysical realm that we can't describe purely mechanically.
Yes.
Because as soon as we try and describe these things mechanically, then the spirit of the thing is lost. And I think that actually all of morality, all of sentiments, all of these things are really spiritual experiences in some way. And to explain them mechanically fails to really understand them. And so there's a whole dimension of human experience that we all experience every day, all the time, when we're talking to our friends, our family, our loved ones, you know, when we're trying to romance a partner, whatever, you know, we're trying to create a kind of magic that they buy into as well. And then together you form this relationship that has a sort of magical essence to it.
Yes.
And everyone knows it. You know, if your friend came in and said, "Oh, I just cheated on my girlfriend," you'd be like, "How could you do that?" You would treat the magical essence that existed between him and his girlfriend as something he had done wrong. Mechanically, you'd be like, "Well, don't get caught." You know, like it wouldn't matter to you. But morally, you know that there's something there that's been damaged.
And here is exactly where the anti-realist sentiment comes in.
Right.
Because you could say that the kind of picture you described is one about, you know, it's a realist position with respect to love. Love is seen as something that is irreducible. You cannot really give an account of it. You can describe it, but you cannot give an account to it that doesn't basically involve its own nature in its definition.
The accounts of it will also be narrow as well. No matter how much time you spend trying to describe this thing, it's got so many dimensions. There's so much to it.
Yes.
It's so complicated. Yes. that you would only be able to describe a thin band of it.
Exactly.
At best, yeah.
And it's not the case for the anti-realists. The anti-realists would try to say that, well, basically this is a sort of feeling that you have, and your brain is basically tricking you into believing, first of all, that there is a self that is enduring.
Right, yeah.
No, we literally have people telling us that the self is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, question is, who is deluded then?
Yeah, who's telling us it's the illusion? Yeah,
if there's no self, who is deluded then?
Yeah.
That's one question.
Yeah.
But they also trying to say that, well, this is a sort of feeling that you have, that you're trying to sugarcoat it somehow.
Right.
You are creating a picture of it in order to present yourself as something other than an animal. And I think
animals can feel love.
Well, maybe, yeah.
I think they can, you know.
Maybe, but I don't know about that. Yeah, I've seen it.
You've got pets.
Yes.
And particular people have a particular relationship with, a certain pet. Like my mum has a parrot, and this parrot just loves to sit on her shoulder and just sort of nuzz her hair. Doesn't do it to my dad, doesn't do it to anyone else, but it does it with my mum.
Yeah.
You know, and there's definitely some particular thing going on.
No,
I think we can describe as love.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
But they want to say that deep down, even in animals, this is a kind of affection that, for instance, a dog is geared to want affection. So the dog is acting in a way that other people, realists about love, try to interpret as it being a sort of love.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually a brute animalistic nature in force.
And there
is no love there. There's only
chemical
biological urge.
Yeah.
Urge. Yeah. Yeah. And that the feelings that we have when when we encounter our loved ones, that they are basically chemicals in the brain.
Yeah. There is a way of looking at the world that in a sense, that's not wrong, right? In a sense, technically, yes, we are all chemicals and we're all acting in a universe. But there are, I guess, what I would call states of affairs that are brought into being through the actions of these chemicals that are not themselves chemical.
Okay.
A relationship is a good example, actually. I don't have to be a part of someone else's relationship to recognize the existence of the relationship. To know, and the fact that I can define the relationship means it must have some substance somewhere. Or else how can we all recognize the thing for what it is? You know, like you don't need to know the material conditions of a couple walking down the street to know that they've been married for a long time, right?
Yes.
You can just, you can tell about someone. So there is something there that exists that is not material. And we all accept this, right? We all know, and everyone knows that, and there's layers and layers of propriety. There's a huge amount of morality attached to this. This is deeply important to those people living through this metaphysical reality.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm very much on the side of there are metaphysics. Even if they are created by humans, that's good enough for me.
Yes.
You know, I don't mind if that's the origin of them. I mean, a lot of religious people say, well, God creates it. Okay, fine. I don't care about the origin. They definitely exist. And I'm happy that they exist. And I think that it's the thing I want to know is, why do you want that to not be the case? Right? What are you trying to achieve by trying to tear down the concept of the sacred and the profane and all of these things? You know,
this is a question that I'm also asking myself, because the main motivation that is being cited is that you don't need to appeal to metaphysical entities in order to explain phenomena. And we constantly have people who they say always, well, I don't want to be deluded. I place truth above all else. And I am trying to basically have the most economic theory with the greatest explanatory power. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be spooked.
So the problem with that is that there are circumstances that defy the mechanistic demands that they, the mechanistic explanations. For example, if you're, say, 25 years old, you became a father at 20, so your 5-year-old son is walking next to you, and you see a car hurtling towards you, and you push him out of the way, and you get hit by the car, and you die. Mechanistically, you've got no reason to do that.
Yeah.
You say, well, I'll just have another son. I've got plenty of time. I can just have another son. But of course, no father in their right mind is going to be like, well, I'll let my son die, and I won't sacrifice myself. It'll be the opposite.
I think, again, they would say that even if you did that, it would be explicable in mechanistic terms. And
but the mechanistic explanation will be something Darwinian. They'll say, well, you know that your genes will pass on. It's like, sure, but why would I want to die to know that? And, you know, I don't know that. You know, my son could get hit by another car 5 minutes later and there's nothing I could do about it. I don't know that. And also, if I didn't sacrifice myself, I could have 2 children or 5 children or 100 children. So it's actually the Darwinian explanation would be on the side of not sacrificing yourself for your children.
Yes. I mean, I think that these are endless conversations. Yeah. I'm trying to lay out in principle the kinds of objections that...
Sorry, yeah, I kind of jumped the gun a bit.
But No.
But I really do hate this kind of materialist view of the universe.
Yeah.
And it brings us to sort of what C.S. Lewis was saying about mere nature. You know, these are the people who use nature as a thing to be conquered. You know, oh, well, we need to overcome the mechanistic. It's like, well, hang on a second. What if there's something generated by the mechanisms that you can't see, you can't touch, but you live through all day, every day, and you can't do without, actually? Yeah. Relationships, I think, are the perfect example of that. You need your relationships, and everyone's relationship is totally unique between them and whatever it is they have a relationship with. No one has a relationship like yours, and they're always, always different. And so I'm very, very much against the materialist worldview these days, and I get a lot of Christians going, and it's like, calm down. But they are wrong.
This is a really fascinating topic, but we could definitely have many discussions about it in the future. I'm more than happy to.
Yeah.
But I really want to show the in principle that any time that someone who says, well, there is true love, or there is true love in the realistic sense, in the strong metaphysical sense, the irreducible one, there will be people who will say constantly, yeah, but it is all matter, and we don't need to appeal to something else. Now, there are all sorts of issues with this worldview, as there are issues with other worldviews as well. I want to be fair, but this is the kind of strategy that anti-realists are using. And when it comes to value, they would say that you don't need to posit objective moral values in order to explain why, for instance, we experience values. They could say that, for instance, you can actually experience what we say, what we think is a moral, the experience of a moral conflict. They could say that you can actually explain it in terms of, you know, brain science, and you constantly don't need to appeal to properties like wrongness and rightness and objective value. That's what the anti-realist would say.
Yeah, it sounds like something that Satan would say.
Well, again, there is also the other the issue with malice, that we shouldn't attribute to wrongdoing to malice when we can attribute it to sometimes ignorance something. But
well, hang on a second.
I don't know what I think about this.
Hang on a second. So, why would I need to abandon notions such as rightness and wrongness? Why would I need to do that? What would be the gain for that? What would be the point of that? And the only the cover for I just want the truth. It's like, well, there are ethical truths, and you're trying to abolish the very notion of them. So I don't know if I agree that you're actually trying for truth. What you are though doing is trying to make good and evil seem as equals, put them on the level playing field, which they're not, I think.
Or as illusions.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as you make them both illusions and they're both the same. So I've got no reason to preference one over the other now, whereas there are tangible physical and moral consequences for being good and for being evil. And so why would I even countenance this line of argument? Like, not only is it obviously wrong, there are obviously things that are non-material that are things that exist in the world and things that we value. But what would be the motivation for a person to do that? And it's just deconstructivist. Like it's trying to remove something that actually is valuable, we do use, and is something that we want to maintain within the world.
Yes, and I think that there are many motivations behind this. There are people who want to, who find these theories as being incredibly helpful in subverting the institutions, or in basically becoming famous.
There is
such a thing. But there is also what I think is, to an extent, tragic, because it doesn't necessarily have to do with malice, but I think it has to do a lot with conceit.
Right.
And here is where the social engineer comes in, the picture. There's a structural parallel that it's just, we cannot ignore it. That just like we have the metaphysician who is, let's say, or the anti-metaphysician who wants to create a theory and wants to understand the universe above all else and says, my one and only one value, fundamentally speaking, is understanding the universe. And I will just let nothing else to come into the picture. My one and only one value is to understand the universe. It's just this kind of detached knowledge.
Yes.
And they want to, they are going to say, well, no, I'll stick into my room. I won't have any social relations, or I won't care that much. All I want to do, every other value is instrumental for my understanding the universe. And the universe can be understood in terms of an economic theory that it makes it also easy for me to tell everyone else is deluded because it's economical and it denies a lot of what we in the first person accept or in the ordinary common sense perspective of the universe. And I think that this leads to a kind of social engineering attitude, because we have people who will, who also want to think this way, and they have a theory, and if it conflicts with the facts, so worse for the facts.
Yeah.
And they do, and the people I have in mind, the, let's say, metaphysicians who want to completely destroy and reject the common sense view of our, of the universe, they are very frequently trying to tell us that there is, that we are completely radically deluded. They know better. If we're radically deluded and they know better, well, they know better how society is to be run. So there is nothing that shouldn't be that shouldn't be under their control.
So there's a lot to this that I think is really, really interesting.
Yes.
The first thing is the desire to have a kind of objective, non-human view of the universe is obviously preposterous.
Yes.
Because I'm talking to a human being, right? The person who espouses this is a human. And so while they may want to have, and what they're essentially aiming for is to be the mind of God. That's what they're asking to be. They say, look, if only I can understand objectively without, shorn of the trappings of being trapped in a human body, what the universe itself and everything in it is, then you're asking to be God, which obviously you can't be. You are trapped in a very, in a time and a place, in a body with particular senses that tell you about the universe, and therefore everything is filtered through this subjective first person lens, right? So before we begin, your mission is impossible and you can't do it, right? So the second thing is, why do you think that's a good idea? Like, what would you as a human being gain? And the answer is, well, not much. And actually you stand to lose a lot, like we were talking about. And the thing, then you go, why, if you've got an impossible mission, and actually you're going to destroy all of the good things about being a human that we work so hard to maintain, isn't that really unreasonable? Like, isn't it a lot more reasonable to begin from a position of, I am a human, I have limited capacities, I experience the world as other humans experience it? Like, suddenly, you know, ground yourself in your own body rather than trying to expand yourself to fill the universe. And actually, you're going to have a lot more of a, if nothing else, a practical, more practical success in whatever it is you're doing. But then also, because you're grounded in yourself as a human being, one, you haven't automatically stigmatized being a human as the barrier to understanding the universe. You can say, well, the best I can do is understand the universe as a human, which is totally reasonable. No one could object to that. No one reasonable anyway could object to that. And that means that you can engage with those things that human beings engage with literally all day, every day, that are not necessarily mechanical, but certainly are the real substance of human existence.
I want to introduce an element into this discussion.
So before we go on, there was actually more to this that I wanted to add on, because then you were saying about the social engineers. Again, C.S. Lewis seems to have presaged this entire conversation, because his view on this is fascinating, because so we've got this deluded group of social engineers who think, actually, no, we are the universal men. We are outside of time and space and the particularity of the human body, and we're going to engineer society.
Yeah.
But where would someone like that find a value set? Right? In what way would you engineer society? And the only answer is mechanistically. So it can only end up being utilitarian. So it can only end up degrading things, because to be against the value of pain and suffering is actually to be against hard work. It's to be against achievement. It's to be against self-sacrifice. It's to be against labor, really. The consequences of these things that change you as a human. But if you're outside of the universe, well, how can you have flaws? You know, if you're literally outside, you're outside of time and space, and you always exist in a never-ending eternal realm, then you've got nothing to say to the human, and you don't understand the human perspective. And so these people, they would say, well, okay, we're going to engineer humanity in a certain way, but they can't explain how they would come to the values they would impose on future generations of humans.
Yes.
And this means that essentially all they're left with are the unspoken presuppositions that they, as humans, which they are, deluding themselves into thinking that they're universal men, have inherited from nature. And so C.S. Lewis calls this sort of nature's final revenge over man, because man thought, oh, I'm conquering nature, I'm you know, I'm creating paracetamol, and I'm creating medicines and mechanical things, and I'm, you know, I'm going to craft the universe. And it ends with the social planner crafting a man who can't even see himself as a man, using the primordial values that nature put into him, because he can't construct any new ones of his own.
I want to introduce a tragic feature.
I think that is tragic.
In the conversation, because this is essentially where what we are going to be discussing, value monism and value pluralism. And one of the main motivations for value monism is precisely what you described.
Mm.
It's the kind of utopian sentiment. Yeah. Now, it's easy to say, okay, utopians are stupid. And to a degree, this is right. But
I wouldn't say stupid. I would say deluded.
I want to give them the benefit of the doubt and try and understand why someone may be attracted to utopianism. Because I think that if we give people we disagree with the benefit of the doubt, we can gain a better understanding of where they come from, and we could possibly find better ways of talking to each other, but also understanding the kinds of threats we are faced with. So the social engineer would say something of the following. Yes, I do try to be a universal man, and even if there are limitations imposed to me by, let's say, my particular nature, it is still a worthy project, because every other system that has kept that has been adopted by human beings hasn't led to, let's say, reduction of conflict or the improvement of our lives. We are still left with a kind of, we are still left with a human, you know, suffering view that we haven't really progressed. So what they are going to say what is the, and this may sound like a villain from a dystopian novel, but this is what makes them interesting.
Oh, and we are under their thumb,
Yes, that ultimately, why should we accept a more tragic view if that more tragic view locks us into suffering? If there is any chance we are going to exit suffering, it's going to be by trying to exit it, not by accepting it and having the moral systems that actually perpetuate suffering.
So this I find this fascinating, because to try and escape suffering is probably the lowest of animalistic values. It is literally anything with a nervous system, millions of years old, you know, a slime wandering around on the bottom of the ocean before life has arrived on the land, tries to escape suffering. It is the lowest of values, the lowest possible value. And so this person who thinks to themselves, well, I'm trying to escape and achieve like the highest value, and their highest value is merely the elimination of suffering. Like that's a really, really low basic value that required no thought to come to, but almost every living thing that has ever lived has always naturally tried to attain, and required no brain power on your part. So, and that's utopia, is it? Where we just don't feel any pain. That's hilariously to me, that hilariously undermines their thesis that, oh, we're such smart and clever and universal men. No, you're totally parochial. You're a slime on the bottom of the ocean that's just trying to avoid, you know, the sulfur vent or whatever it is, you know. And also this kind of mechanistic value, anti-realist. Oh, I don't. That metaphysics and that, no, you're showing your values right there, right? You want everything to be reduced to the state of lowest common denominator. You are expressing your values, because you can say, well, I want a world without suffering. It's like, no, I want suffering. I'm pro-suffering. I actively value suffering. You know, now what can we say to each other?
So it depends what we count as suffering. And this was also the theme of previous symposium that I did with Rory on Schopenhauer. Yeah. Because there is such a thing as a very, let's say, extended view of what suffering is. That a concept that basically involves suffering, like, okay, you were rejected by a girlfriend.
Yep.
Boo-hoo.
Suffering. That's suffering. You were misgendered. That's suffering.
Yeah, but that's excessive.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you.
Suffering I have in mind is much more tragic. It's the kind of, you know, just imagine the life of people who were basically slaves of people of other people in fleets, and they were dying in a naval battle because they were rowing, and you know, they had the horrified death.
Yeah,
and or others who were tortured by the Assyrians.
Yeah, like the, you know,
that's suffering. It's not having a girlfriend, a woman say no to you.
I totally agree, but the underlying continuum where it's being rejected by a girl to burning to death in a Roman fleet fighting the Carthaginians or something, where you can't escape and you're chained to the oars or whatever, right? Burning to death on that continuum of awfulness is still the continuum of suffering, right? And so the value monist can only see the continuum of suffering and can't place any value higher than that. And so, whereas I am with you on this one, like, obviously, like, the continuum of, I mean, it's probably not even a straight line. It's probably like that, right?
Yeah.
Where, or some strange squiggly line. And there are other values that intersect over this. And you say, okay, It is not pleasant to be rejected by a girl.
Yes.
But it's also not pleasant to remain an adolescent for your whole life.
Yes.
And if you want to be a man, you have to get rejected by a girl at some point.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.